Ms. Gray, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
I thought I would start by asking you to talk about something that you you get to write very near the beginning of the book. And one of the things that you say there is that one of the first things that you ask Soviet women when you start talking with them is their view of Western women, particularly American women, and try to get out, as they see it, some of the differences between Soviet and American women. What sort of things do they tell you?
That they certainly envy a lot of things in American women's lives, our abundance of goods, our commodities, but what they envy more than anything else is our men. They have this enormously idealized and romantic and perhaps accurate view of American men as being the most courteous, the most thoughtful, the most gallant men in the world. And this comes from maybe decades of seeing a certain kind of Western film, which is very popular in the Soviet Union, which the male is the heroic savior of the, you know, of the underclass, and particularly the rescuer woman. It comes from a great cult of John Kennedy, which they had. It comes from many, many things. But it is quite striking, and it is always sort of juxtaposed with their complaints against the passivity and boorishness of Soviet men. And I think that's the one thing I would single out as a real kind of idealization and glamorization of the American male. It's quite fascinating among Soviet women.
Well, certainly one of the things that comes through quite clearly as you relate the conversations you've had with many women is that they are pretty unhappy about the men in their lives, and not just their husbands, but just the idea of the Soviet man in general. And it makes me wonder a lot of things. First of all, whether that's really fair in a sense, or whether they somehow don't have in their minds an idea of an ideal man that no man anywhere would be able to quite live up to.
That's a very interesting observation, David, of your own, because on one hand, Russian Soviet men, speaking of the Russian Federation, do tend to be more passive and more, just laid back and inactive than the average Western man, but you have to see why. For centuries under Tsardom, they were not allowed to use their initiative or their free will. They were in serfdom, in effect. There is a very striking similarity to the situation of the blacks in America, whose egos and psyches were broken by centuries of slavery. Same with the Russian male. Under Tsar, the men served him as a boss, let's say, in 1862. 40 years later came the revolution, and he had to endure an equal kind of serfdom under the communist regime. Women did not suffer as much from these political hardships. They seemed to, because they always had their own little kingdoms to rule at home. And that gave them the kind of sense of superiority and essentialness society, which men don't have. So in a way, there is a deep historical reason as to why the female has this enormous sense of superiority and towards the male. But at the same time, I think they tend to be very tyrannical women with a very, very strong will to dominate. I'm half Russian, I had Russian mother, so I know. And they tend to resent the fact that they themselves are not a bit dominated. What they have, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that their quandary is similar to that of many, many women going through the stages of women's liberation now, who've reached their careers and often have sometimes jobs that are more powerful than those of their husbands or companions, and who half resent, whether subconsciously resent, the fact that there is no more kind of shining male to protect and overwhelm them. I think this is a very secret desire of the female everywhere in the world, and I think the Soviet women particularly suffer from that.
Mm. You know, I think that we have a stereotype of Soviet women, and I think that perhaps that we probably get it from them. That is, this is a stereotype that they have projected to the outside world, and one that they seem, in a sense, to believe in. That is the idea that the Soviet woman is somehow a superwoman. And it's interesting that Soviet women seem to be in a sense of two minds about this kind of stereotype, that in a sense they recognize that it may in fact be an excuse for continued oppression, but at the same time they seem to be rather proud of it.
Yes, they are superwomen in the sense that there is no society in the world in which they have had such a double burden. Here's a society of women who for 70 years now have been employed full-time, 95% or so of them. Two-thirds of Soviet doctors are women. More than half of its engineers, more than half of its lawyers. But at the same time, they are exclusively in charge of standing in queue for food, sometimes even foraging for food, of keeping the family together, of keeping the household together. These are essentially female domains, which the male does not enter there. So by walking the tightrope, the title of my book, the subtitle, I really implied this balancing act we have to do between these two functions, and of course I think three functions, a triple tightrope act, because there's also the problem of penury and surviving the terrible penury of goods and of commodity that is there. But they survived it, and they their phrase is goes this way more or less, to reaction the woman started to say, of course we're vastly overburdened, but we wouldn't give it up to the world. It's part of our mystique. And they would not let their men into the kitchen, even when they're most tired, because it takes away from their power. It's a very strange complex. It's rather made perhaps sadomasochistic in nature. But as to archetype, I mean stereotype, I think you hit the right word. I think we have a lot of stereotypes about each other, Soviet Union and we, curiously, that are left over from the Cold War days. Mm-hmm. The Cold War days still show the Soviet woman as a kind of Amazon driving a tractor, you know, on a kohos, on a collective form, or operating cranes, whatever, sort of very masculine, sort of flat shoes, unisex in a physique. Actually, she has become, 30 years later, a woman craving for femininity, often scrounging for Western cosmetics, Western clothes, absolutely obsessed with fashion and with external appearance, very coquettish, profoundly feminine, and really quite different from that stereotype we get in the posters.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there's at one point where you talk about... when you ask a Soviet woman what traits that she would like her daughter to have, you say the most frequent response is womanliness.
That's right. And, you know, there was a group of Soviet women in Connecticut where I lived this weekend, whom I met with and at some function, and I interpreted for them. And I asked them the question, how would you, as a feminist, because there are very few feminists in the Soviet Union, that's another issue we should explore, but two of these three women did call themselves a feminist, and as a feminist, how are you going to bring up your daughter into a feminist? And their answer was, I'm going to make her aware of her femininity and her femaleness. Now, this is so ironic, because in a way, in the West, the women's movement has meant, let's be like more like the boys, let's be unisex, let's get into the men's world through our careers, let's forget about cosmetics and external appearance. And there, because they were forced by the state to take on unisex jobs, to take on a drab unisex appearance for so many decades, that the feminist is the one who is going to want to be feminine and stress the female qualities. And the domestic qualities, I mean, it's a very topsy-turvy world over there.
Let me just really quickly reintroduce our guest for this morning. We're speaking with Francine Duplessis-Gray, and we're talking about her book, Soviet Women Walking the Tightrope, which came out fairly recently. It's published by Doubleday. It's the product of some traveling that she did in the Soviet Union, talking with many women, trying to get an understanding about what their life is like. And again, as we talk, if you have questions or comments, 333-WILL is the local number, 333-9455. And we have that toll-free line, too. That's 800-222-9455. You mentioned, and you also mentioned in the book, that some of your interest in wanting to get to know contemporary Soviet women better comes from the fact that you were raised by Russian women, not in Russia, but in France. And if I do correct me if this is wrong, I have this wrong. Your father was French, but your mother was Russian.
Right.
And that there were many other Russian women relatives.
Great-grandmother, great-aunt, a couple of other aunts, Russian nanny, they were all Russian women who were taking care of me.
Did you find that there was a continuity between those women that you knew who raised you and the women that you met more recently?
Absolutely. That will to dominate, that will to overpower is very much among my female phobias, and I think surviving it has made me also stronger. But beside that, what they had, they were all women who had careers. Even then, my great-grandmother had a doctorate in mathematics, and my great-aunt was a teacher of opera singing. My mother was a fashion designer. Her own sister was a musician. They all had careers, and they combined to a greater degree than I find most women in the West have managed now, a high degree of professional competence with very traditional female domestic values, a love for the home, a sense of the home, a sense of creating a cozy atmosphere, a love and skill for the domestic arts, such as cooking, receiving very well. This profound femaleness, which they seem to be able to combine with a high degree of professional competence, that's maybe the trait which we can learn from the most, this deep sort of nurturing, cozy generosity that they have toward each other and also toward strangers, and which have certainly was lost in the very first phases of our feminist movement. And the women who brought me up had that, and the women I most admire in the Soviet Union now have that. And I think that's a point which we can all benefit from studying.
Is it the case that mothers somehow actively pass on to daughters these qualities, or is it more a matter of role modeling, and that little girls, and as they grow into be young women, just pattern themselves after the women that are around them, mothers, aunts, teachers, whatever?
I think it's in part that they absorb their mother's energy, and that's where the girls are much better off, even psychologically at an early age, than the boys, because they absorb their mother's energy. It's often a single-parent home. I would say that in the Russian Federation, two marriages out of three ending in divorce for a variety of reasons. And so it is always the children are always awarded to the mother in any kind of divorce suit. And it is the girl identifying and with the mother and absorbing the mother's energy. And also, there is this curious phenomenon that school teachers from kindergarten on seem to greatly favor girls. They're very overworked. They're overtired. The class is large. Girls, by their very nature, and I'm a feminist who believes in their gender traits, girls by their very nature at that age tend to be more docile, more cooperative, more earnest, more hard, more industrious, diligent. And these are all, and can be more communitarian, more altruistic. These are all the primary qualities stressed by the Soviet state as traits of great citizenship. And so that somehow the girls' innate gender traits correspond much more than young men's innate gender traits, which are more individualistic and more aggressive. They correspond much more, these female traits, to the ideal citizenship model presented by the Soviet state. And said all these factors collaborate in making for a much stronger female psyche than it could create a male psyche.
Hmm. I think it's quite fascinating. At one point, you talk about visiting a daycare center,
yeah.
And it's you can see these kind of qualities emerge apparently quite young, as you would see a rather a reversal of roles.
Exactly.
From what you would expect to see, in an American daycare center.
That's right. And all the more striking that the daycare center I described is in Tashkent in Central Asia. So here I'm talking about really Soviet system and not cultural traits, because this is, after all, former Islam. And this is a society in which women were oppressed even in the first decades of the Soviet regime, and they had to abandon their veils and their purdah and all the accoutrements of the Islamic oppression of women. But even there, I found that it's the girls who kept running up to me and asking me questions and foraging through my camera bags and being really the aggressive sort. While my children were growing up, I have two sons, I found that in that same age group, it's always the boys who are asked the most questions and being most aggressive. And here there's a complete reversal from that American pattern of female passivity and male aggression. And I do think that's something which is inculcated by the Soviet state rather than by any kind of deep-seated ethic and cultural tradition of the past.
Hmm. Well, I have a caller to talk with. We hope we have some other folks who have questions. The telephone number is locally 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL, and we'll go to our toll-free line for the first caller. Hello.
Hi, I want to keep on talking about child care that you're talking about now, because full government financed child care, as is available in the Soviet Union, a decade or so ago, we Americans viewed that kind of government child care with horror. We associated with Nazis and communists, and it was very evil because it took, we said it was very evil because it took babies away from their mothers. And now that both Nazism and communism have been proven totally bankrupt, we ourselves are moving toward that kind of government rearing of our own children. And in the past, I have seen, just in the recent past, I have seen the media present the communist system of child care as some kind of a model that we ought to emulate. What do you think?
Well, sir, I certainly would not use a Soviet model as something to emulate right now. Use a Scandinavian model, a Swiss model, or the French model, and many others, because what you find in the Soviet daycare systems presently is that there's been terrible degeneration of the system in the past two decades, particularly during the Brezhnev era. Government daycare centers are so overcrowded, and many of them are so badly kept that most mothers are staying home for two or three years after the child is born, and sacrificing their promotion and their income and really their careers to taking care of their child by themselves. You have reports of daycare workers so corrupt that they willfully, deliberately induce colds in the children by keeping the windows open the coldest days of the winter in order that the class might be small and they might have less work, and reports of daycare workers who adulterate the youngsters' milk with water and take the rations of milk home for themselves. It's just appalling what you hear. So I think that the very principle of government daycare centers is marvelous and that we need it badly. But I certainly would not use the present Soviet model. I would use the Scandinavian, as I say, or Swiss or French model for that, because right now, like everything else in the Soviet Union, daycare centers are in a state of terrible chaos.
Well, that's very interesting. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you for the call. This morning we're speaking with novelist and essayist Francine Duplessis-Gray, and we're talking with her about her book, Soviet Women, Walking the Tightrope. It's recently published by Doubleday. If you have questions, pick up the telephone and give us a call. One of the things that seems to be rather ironic about the Soviet Union, as far as women are concerned, is that as almost as a matter of state policy, since the period of the revolution, the emancipation of women was given a very high priority. And at the same time, for all of the kind of power that women seem to possess in the society, as far as the state is concerned, it has responded, I think, rather poorly to some pretty basic needs. something as mundane as and yet important as not being able to get tampons, for example, or something more important and not really having good access to birth control, really are just two examples of the ways in which it seems that, the state thinks very little of some rather basic needs.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And they, I think that what you've got to keep aware of there is that the women were never emancipated into the labor force in the Soviet Union back in 17 for the same kind of humanistic libertarian reasons for which all women in the West were emancipated. They were emancipated for purely pragmatic utilitarian reasons. They were emancipated in order to get an unbelievably retarded society going onto the path of industrialization. They needed every pair of hands they could to get out of their almost medieval status. And so they emancipated the women in the workforce in order to double their workforce. So what you get 40 years later, you find the women with the double burden of triple burden of penury and home and career, and you find a state that is really as indifferent to its needs as it as ever was, because as I said, they didn't emancipate them for their needs, they emancipated for the needs of the state. And I think this is a lesson on how you always fall into a bad political and moral situation when you use inhuman beings as means to an end, having been used to as means to an end, having been used as producers and reproducers, producers of the goods the state needs and reproducers for the future labor force, which is increasingly waning. Women are neglected to such a degree that indeed there is no form of contraception available to them except abortion. What do we have in way of birth control devices? We have a diaphragm made of metal and only made in two sizes. We have condoms that one out of two of which are so badly made they break up on first use, and only one strut out of 18 or so can ever will ever carry them. It's, you have to really scour the city for a condom. And nothing else. You no pill, no IUD. Maybe if you're a high party apparatchik, you can get yourself an IUD from East Germany, something like that. So the only way of family planning is abortion, and the rate is staggering. It's the highest rate in the world. It's something like between five and eight abortions per birth. I have a lot of statistics on that issue and a lot of observations. I went to abortion clinics and saw the women staggering out and have them describe what it's like to be aborted in a hall spattered with blood with seven other women being aborted at the same time. No anesthesia, nothing. It's as bad as what you hear about Romania, but it's the other way. It's imposition of abortion on women. There is this neglect extends, of course, to such other hygienic details, such as the fact that they have, as you say, no tampons. For years I wondered why Soviet women carry such huge shoulder bags on their shoulder strap bags on their shoulder when they go to work. Well, because they have to carry huge wads of cotton a few days a month. That's the only kind of thing that they have, is a sanitary napkin. And when often the farmers run out of cotton, they have to resort to carefully saved cotton rags. Now, this is a country which has a first world superstructure, but which has a third world infrastructure. I think you always have to keep that in mind. I refer to the Soviet Union as fourth world. But it's a third world infrastructure toppling under the increasing weight of a first world superstructure, and that makes for one of the shakiest societies you will ever find, and one of the most dehumanized.
Is it, taking, for example, the problem with the availability of reliable birth control, is this because as a society, or perhaps the government of the Soviet Union, thinks that it's not important, or is there some sort of another sort of attitude that there's something wrong with birth control, or maybe there's something wrong with sexuality? Maybe that's the most important issue.
I think you've hit the nail on the head again. I think that there's an extremely puritanical society. You have to account for the puritanism of the Orthodox Church, which is vastly, vastly more severe kind of Puritanism than we ever either had in Protestantism or in the Roman Catholic Church even. And discussion of sexual matters or of any issue which touched upon women's bodies was always forbidden. Even before the Revolution, it was not even supposed to be good well-mannered to speak about it within the family or to one's husband. Then you get the imposition of Marxist Puritanism upon these centuries of Orthodox Puritanism, and you get a society in which basic words like sexuality or prostitution or menstruation were never allowed in the media until about 3 years ago, until a year or two into Gorbachev's glasnost. Now, how are you going to have women able to lobby for better birth control devices if they can't mention it in conversation or in the press? That's one side of it. The other side of it is that the Soviet system always put its priority on the superstructure, on the production of more industrial goods, and on the heavy artillery of life, let's say, and totally sacrificed the individual needs to that heavy artillery of the superstate power structure. And there is no way that it can reconcile these two women's needs to that sense of priority that it has. So there are many reasons why there is a sexuality, the Puritanism about sexuality. I think there's also kind of disdain for women, deep-read disdain for women, and a kind of fear of women's sexuality, which is built into the Orthodox theology that we inherited. And all that these prejudices build up to a situation in which women only in the past 2 or 3 years have been able to even mention the fact that they can't have proper birth control devices or proper hygienic details in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Something else that comes across in the book, and I'm you mentioned the fact that there are women in all professions, and certainly in the professional fields as well. And in fact, I think in the book you mentioned at one point that 92% of all women are fully employed, and they make up more than half the workforce. They're like 51% of the workforce, and at the same time, they make I think only 2/3 what men make, and they seem to be often relegated to the more menial sorts of jobs.
Right. The average wage of the Soviet female, even though her level of education is slightly higher than that of the male, please note, her average wages are only 2/3 of that of the male worker. Now, there are many reasons why that happens. Women are looked on as a rather unstable workforce because of the fact that they have to take leave of absence to have children. And this has gotten worse. This inequality between men and women, I think, has gotten worse in the past 20 years as the daycare system, as well as all human services, degenerated terribly under Brezhnev's rule, with the result that nearly all women, as I said before, take 2 or 3 years off as per each child in order to keep them out of daycare centers. So that the state, having not provided anything for the care of infants, is left with, as they say, an unstable workforce. Women get behind in their research. And I think that in general, you see, it's a very oriental society. We are in Byzantium as soon as we cross the border into Soviet Union. I say, when each time I fly in, I say, goodbye, West. You know, here I am back in the Orient. That women are still thought of as not fully human beings that the man is. They're thought of as perhaps more pragmatic and more nurturing than men, but they're not thought of as human beings who will ever be able to catch up intellectually with men, even after 70 years of having proved themselves as scientists. There are deep prejudices against the lesser intelligence of women. And one of the ironies of Gorbachev's glasnost is that it has allowed these sexist prejudices to come out into the open, just the way it's allowed anti-Semitism to go out into the open. Now you hear guys saying at open meetings, over the dinner table, even publishing the press, statements like, women have no place in politics, or a good society is one in which women look charming, are beautifully dressed, and don't need to work. But I mean, these are statements in which any guy guy would have been booed out of any public forum and accused of bourgeois counter-revolutionary attitude the first 7 decades of the Soviet state. So there are many, many double-edged swords to Gorbachev's glasnost in relation to women, which have to be accounted for. And that is certainly one of them, this increasing sexist attitude on the inequality between men's and women's intelligence, which is very, very much being aired these days. I came back from Moscow last week, so I heard it more than ever, even more than I had heard it last year.
One point I wanted to ask you about, and it seems there's a convergence here, and maybe that's what raised in my mind between healthcare and women's employment and so forth, is that there seems to be a prejudice in Soviet society against women physicians, and although I don't know if that's just I'm remembering male physicians having said that in the book. Do I have that right? That somehow
you have it right, but I'll explain. It's even worse than that. It's not only male physicians who have disrespect for female physicians. It's also women patients do not take women doctors as seriously as they take male doctors. I have countless Soviet women friends who will say, I've had two of my children, you know, with a woman doctor, and one of my children with a man doctor. How much more gentle and powerful and competent the male doctor was. And this happens all the time. You hear it consistently, and it's something very wounding to someone who's tried to struggle along as a centrist feminist, such as myself, who really feels that, yes, there are bad and good doctors, but you cannot blame it on gender. Very primitive approach to gender issues is really quite disturbing. And yes, indeed, the women doctors are very much looked down on and by the whole society. And you've got to remember that also when you say that two-thirds of women of doctors in the Soviet Union are women, a figure which makes any average, you know, Western feminist swoon with envy, you've got to see it in the light of the fact that medicine is a very underprivileged vocation, and the average doctor only earns 250 rubles a month, which is the average salary in the Soviet Union, one half only of what a skilled factory worker earns. Mm. And that's maybe why women are allowed into the medical profession with such abundance, because very few men want that profession. There isn't enough money in it. And that's why medicine is so bad.
Well, I have some other callers here that we'd like to talk with. Let's do that.
Okay.
We'll go to our toll-free line again. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions. In a way, I'm finding this conversation very discouraging, but I wondered if 0.5% of Soviet women are attorneys, or 0.5% of Soviet attorneys are women. Is that correct?
A bit more than a half, yeah.
Okay. Do they not have any power to make laws? As, for instance, in this country, you could be elected and you could get into the lawmaking process. I realize making laws cannot really change attitudes, but is there any hope in this area that there could be?
I think there is hope, but first of all, we're talking about a state which never had direct elections until last year,
right.
That there was only one-party candidates, and the whole electoral system is a complete sham. One of the interesting things about the past few years is that it has led women to realize that they could and should take full participation in the political life. They had always kept abeyance from it during the Stalin years, the Brezhnev years, as if they had a really kind of instinctual sense that how corrupt it was. And they're very proud now for not having meddled in politics for all those decades. Would you want to have participated in the Congress under Stalin? No, not it was I.
No, that's very frightening.
Frightening. And so now that only this electoral process is only beginning, now I quite agree with you. I think what we need in the Supreme Soviet is a couple of hundred women like of the medal of Pat Schroeder and Barbara Mikulski, and women of that caliber, who will lobby for more care centers, for better gynecology, for better health care in general, for all those fundamentals of daily life of which they've been deprived for decades. And I think that's the real only, really the only hope is for them to use the electoral system and to lose the cynicism with which they viewed it for all these decades.
Do any Soviet physicians, female, are they able to travel abroad and attend medical conferences?
Oh, yes. There's been a huge amount of professional cultural exchange. I just over the weekend met with a group of Soviet women lawyers, and there are lawyers' exchanges, there are doctors' exchanges, all kinds. And they come back from their first trip to the United States almost weeping with shame.
I have just one more question.
Yeah.
There have been many programs done, by Phil Donahue and so on, about American-Soviet marriages and how disastrous they can be.
Do you mean more the American woman with a Soviet male or the Soviet woman?
Well, I believe,
woman?
Yeah, it looked to me more like it was the American male who might go there and then meet a Soviet woman, and they married and they had children, but the woman could never leave. She was never allowed to leave.
Well, now they're allowed to leave, but I think the drama is of another kind. Anybody is allowed to leave with a spouse. Anybody can almost immigrate freely. I think the drama is goes along this line that the Soviet woman comes to the United States with a very overly idealized view of life here. She thinks that it's going to be just one big. You know, with sand and coconut palms. They have this idea of America is very tropical. It's one of the strangest stereotypes.
You know, this is true about many immigrants who come
here. Yeah. And they think it's going to be just one gorgeous beach. It's going to all look like Hawaii.
Yeah.
And then they come into a society in which, only about 10 or 15% of our doctors and lawyers are women, and they sort of wonder at that. And it's hard for them to get jobs. And it's hard for them to get accustomed to the American habit of discussing private problems and putting them up for an airing. That is the toughest thing they have. They're used to talking about their private problems or sexual problems with their girlfriends. They're terrified of airing their problems openly. And I think it's one of the things they find hardest about American men who want to talk about, you know, orgasms or their sexual needs or whatever, or whole society, which is so permissive, that to them is very, very difficult. And that's one of the many points in which they find life is hard to adjust here.
Thank you very much.
All right, I thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest this morning in this first part of Focus is Francine Duplessis-Gray, and we're talking about her book, Soviet Women, Walking the Tightrope. We have some other callers here, and we'd be happy to try to get in as many as we can before we run out of time. 333-WILL, that's the local number, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Our next caller here is on line one. Hello.
Hi, I have a question about the vulnerability and fear which women in the Soviet Union feel, and I'm interested more in the sexual discrimination and abuse they have to deal with in their own families and from the society. For example, like fear of going out in the night in the dark and fear of males, or things like that. Thank you.
Do you mean that it is so much more dangerous to walk in American cities at night than to walk in Soviet cities?
I think, well, the caller is hung up. My understanding of his question was, I guess he was asking, are Soviet women concerned about that? Are they concerned about being attacked
less so than, first of all, they have another funny stereotype. They think of Chicago as crime city. It's good for, but like they say, we are becoming like Chicago. It in Moscow, the crime rate has tripled in Moscow in the past year alone. An English tourist in the floor below me at the hotel last week only was stabbed by a gangster at 11:30 at night, right on this hotel, right almost on Red Square. I mean, it's unbelievable. You cannot walk the streets of Moscow alone anymore, whether you're a man or a woman. So, and I think that there is now less of that particular disparity. In the sense that they know that it is as violent in back home in the Soviet Union as it is in New York. On the domestic scene, I'd like to point out an interesting fact that there is still an awful lot of domestic violence which stems from the very high rate of male alcoholism. But because of this puritanical reluctance to discuss any family or intimate problems, an estimated 2% of Soviet women ever reveal or discuss domestic violence or report it to authorities. And that's about as low a figure as you'll get in any non-Islamic country, I believe.
All right. Let's take another caller here. Line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the difference between the urban phenomenon and more rural and smaller towns. But I also wanted to, the thing about urban crime, the Soviet Union, it's three times greater than what it was, but it was always so much smaller that it seems to me that the comparison between Moscow and New York would still, as far as crime goes.
There's a crippling of crime in the past year alone in Moscow alone. That's mm-hmm. the figure I gave you. And that's a terrifying figure, the tripling of crime. That includes rape, assault, theft, all those. So they seem to think, the ones, the Soviets who travel a great deal, and there's a whole new kind of class of Soviets who travel all the time. They're businessmen, they're employed by American firms, or they're the jet-setting professors and academics. They seem to think that Moscow is getting to be just about as dangerous as New York. But I do want to say that whenever they talk about a growing crime rate, they do say, you are like Chicago, we're becoming like Chicago. They don't think of New York as a violent city. They think of all the crime in the United States as being centered in Chicago. And that's another stereotype, like the sort of tropical stereotype of American society they have.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask about, one thing in Gorbachev's book, I didn't read it entirely, but there was one section that looked anti-feminist to me. It was talking about women being allowed to be more womanly.
I know the section by heart, and I'll tell you something about that. Earlier in this program, I stated that the feminist ideal in the Soviet Union is the absolutely inverse or opposite of what it is here. Here it has been, of course, forgetting sexual differences, unisex behavior, forgetting about personal appearance, leaving behind cosmetics and fashion, blah, blah, blah. Over there, at the contrary, because the state imposed 70 years of unisex, drab exterior appearance, the woman who is a so-called emancipated woman is going to go hog wild for a coquettish appearance, for polishing up her femininity, her femaleness, and above all, for the freedom of choice as to whether she wants to work or not. Because the obligation to work as a sign of good citizenship, they associate with the worst part of the Bolshevik ethic. And so you've got to read that sentence of Gorbachev's, which made me very uncomfortable when I read it myself, and which I discuss in my book at length. You've got to read it more from the point of view of their own cultural history, of women who are finally enabled to make choices of lifestyle and of appearance and everything else. In the Stalin years, you would be fired and perhaps go to camp if you wore a green skirt that would separate you from the rest of the crowd. So I think that you've got to... And you also would be discriminated against in your workplace if they knew that you were knitting or cooking. These are not things that you were supposed to do. And Gorbachev's Satan has to be seen in the light of that past.
Well, thanks for that explanation, but... there was one other thing, and I don't know if you experienced it in France, but I think it was in the late 50s, maximum Cold War McCarthy era, there was this image of the godless, lecherous communists, and I'm trying to figure out if there's any basis for that at all, or was that just part of the propaganda machine? Maybe it wasn't as active in Europe, but this idea of the puritanical Soviet Union doesn't match up, and I'm wondering if there are at least some urban subcultures that reflect our...
Well, they're both puritanical, and their attitudes about not discussing sexuality, but they're also very promiscuous. I mean, it's nothing is nothing is one-sided. Everything has to be grasped in paradoxical form. It's also a very permissive society where I would say great majority of young couples have sexual relations before they marry. It's permissive in many ways. So it is not clear-cut Puritanism. And I never meant to sound like that. It is puritanical in the sense of not discussing verbally sexual issues or intimate problems. It is not at all puritanical in behavior. That's the difference.
I'm afraid we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I wish we could continue, but we've simply come to the end of our time. And I want to thank you very much, Ms. Gray, for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, sir.
Our guest this morning, Francine Duplessis Gray, and if you were interested in reading her book, it is entitled Soviet Women, Walking the Tightrope, and Doubleday is the publisher.